Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're about to make a start. Who's missing? Okay, it's the last time we take a break. Trying to get everybody together afterwards is a bit difficult. But anyway, I hope this panel comes with even more energy than the previous panel. We're focusing on energy, and I'm sure it's going to generate a lot of interest. The aim, I think, is to take a little bit of a step back from all the complex and sometimes confusing negotiations over transportation, supplies, prices, volumes, and so forth, and try and look a little bit at the bigger strategic picture, as well as the national interests pertaining to the energy question of major, medium, and some of the smaller players involved. In what I suppose is a competition over transit routes and energy supplies through the South Caucasus. We have four top analysts and a top respondent, my co-chair here. So let me introduce them very quickly so we can get into the meat of things. First of all, we have Neil Brown, a special advisor to Senator Richard Lugar, and a professional staff member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Neil handles energy security and related foreign policy, environmental and economic issues, and directs the Lugar Energy Initiative. Secondly, my good friend and colleague from former RFE days, Vladimir Sokor, political analyst of East European Affairs for the Jamestown Foundation and a daily writer for the Eurasia Daily Monitor. His main specialization focuses on the political affairs and ethnic conflicts of the former Soviet republics, but in recent years he's become, I think, one of the key authorities on the energy strategy questions, not just in the South Caucasus, but between Russia, Caspian Basin, and Europe. Third, we have Koray Ertas. He serves as counselor of the Turkish embassy here in Washington, and he is responsible for economic and energy issues, as well as congressional liaison. He previously served as deputy chief of cabinet to the Turkish president and former foreign minister Abdullah Gül. And fourth, we have Elin Suleymanov. He has been Azerbaijan's first consul general to Los Angeles, with personal rank of envoy extraordinary and plenipotentiary since November 2005. Prior to that, he served as senior counselor at the Foreign Relations Department, Office of the President in Baku, and as press officer of the Azerbaijani embassy in Washington. And our commentator, I won't introduce, is Ariel Cohen. So let us begin with Neil.
I assume the red light means on. Intuitive there. Well, thanks so much for the introduction, and thanks also to CSIS for inviting me here. I always like to come here because my first job in Washington, well, it wasn't a job, it was an internship, was here at CSIS, and I remember sitting in this room with John Hamry, getting all sorts of good advice that actually led me to want to come back to Washington, which is something of a rarity, I think, amongst a lot of folks in the intern position. But I want to start with just what I mean by the Southern Corridor. Essentially, any routes opening up oil and gas trade between Central Asia, the Caucasus, Turkey, and onward to European and global markets. We've had a lot of success. The BTC pipeline, Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan pipeline, is operational, and it has been a great political success as well as a success for energy markets. Likewise, the South Caucasus pipeline, connecting those three countries, again, for natural gas, is operational. And we have oil shipments from Kazakhstan across the Caspian to Baku. So these are all good things. The goal now for the Southern Corridor is to work on the two ends of the existing pipeline, to open up trade across the Caspian, primarily to Turkmenistan, and the onward connection, the so-called Nabucco pipeline, primarily from Turkey onward to Europe. Now, as you know, probably very little of the hydrocarbons from Central Asia will probably reach the U.S. Maybe some oil, but almost definitely no gas. So why do we care about it? And for that matter, I want to talk a little bit about why we care about energy security in Eurasia generally, not knowing exactly the expertise of this audience. I'll mention five things why we care, why Senator Lugar gives great priority to this. as well as the Foreign Relations Committee, which has been very active. The first reason is that we just have a domestic interest in well-functioning and well-supplied global energy markets. It doesn't matter where it's coming from and where it's going, more molecules means more security for the U.S. and greater price stability. And, of course, Russia and Central Asia has huge reserves, some of the biggest outside of the Middle East and outside of West Africa. The second reason is that we have a deep interest in independent and economically viable states in Central Asia. These states are front lines in our war in Afghanistan and our concerns in Pakistan and Iran. And they're important for agriculture, for nonproliferation. So we want them to be strong and independent, which is imperiled in the current energy situation where they're dependent on Russia for export routes. The third reason is energy security is vital for democratic consolidation, economic growth, and independence of Eastern European countries, which are important for the Congress for all sorts of reasons, both domestic constituencies as well as our relations in NATO and other organizations. The fourth reason is because energy security is vital for a well-functioning European community, talking within Europe, including the EU, as well as the transatlantic alliance. Reliable energy supply is an existential issue. I mean, it's existential for the United States. We spend a lot of time, as you see in the newspaper, debating domestic energy policy. For our European allies, particularly Eastern European allies, reliable energy supplies is important for absolutely necessary for economic growth, for military strength, for making sure that the citizens' homes are warm in the winter, which means that reliable energy supplies is necessary for stable governments and for the survival of governments. Unfortunately, over the last 5 or 6 years, energy security concerns have had, a somewhat divisive effect, with certain countries going out and trying to broker bilateral deals primarily with Russia. That's led to some development of, I guess, the Nord Stream, South Stream pipelines, which we have some concerns about, although not necessarily are opposed to. But it's also challenged the unity of the transatlantic alliance. I think you see that most strongly within NATO and the decision, I guess, a year and a half ago now, related to Ukrainian and Georgian NATO membership and primarily Russian opposition to that. Energy was one of their great tools of influence in those discussions. And the fifth reason, and this I think relates strongly to the discussion that was just had here, is that energy cooperation is good for building relations within the Caucasus, for stability, for understanding. You see that with the BTC pipeline. That was a big effort. And the governments in those countries, in Turkey, Georgia, and Azerbaijan, had to take a gamble to make that happen. And it's paid off. And the good thing about cooperation on energy security in this region is that it's decidedly in the interests of the players involved. Yes, it's in U.S. interest, but that's not the overwhelming factor here. It's in their interest, in their economic interest, in their geopolitical interests. So moving ahead on energy, within Europe, and I would include Turkey in that, we have to have a broad strategy. We have to advocate all sorts of policies. I sort of identify pipeline interconnectivity, gas storage, renewables development, LNG, nuclear development, and in partnership with European countries, as well as other countries we're discussing today, we need to work on better coordination of supply issues and diplomatic advocacy of those supplies, good governance, transparency in markets. But the Southern Corridor is really the critical element of that strategy today. And why is that? Well, as I said, it'll bolster Central Asian, Caucasian independence of those countries. It'll be an alternative import route for Europe. It's a general principle: diversification enhances market function, reduces the incentive for political manipulation. And I think probably the most important reason is that the Nabucco pipeline in particular will be a very, very, well, solid. I mean, you can actually see it. It's physical. And a bold demonstration of unity on energy security where you haven't had a great deal of it within Europe in particular. To get there, we have to reinforce U.S. commitment to Central Asian and Caucasian countries writ large. It's not just about energy. That's one of the things we need to move on right away, but we have to have our ambassadors there. We have to have high-level visits. I believe Undersecretary Burns is there even as we speak or next week. We have to reinforce the priority of energy security. Secretary Clinton has been strongly in favor. She has her envoy, Ambassador Morningstar, who works very well and we coordinate with. But most important right now is that we have to encourage Azerbaijan and Turkey to come to agreement on gas transit for Shah Deniz 2 gas development and to demonstrate to other supply countries that this can happen. Just to close with one thought, our support for the Southern Corridor is largely a response to Russian monopolistic position, particularly over Eastern European countries, but it's not anti-Russian. Over the long term, better functioning markets will benefit the Russian people. It'll be a more reliable source of income. There'll be a feedback loop for investment that's needed in Russian domestic energy industry. And it also will lower the independence, it will lower the suspicion of Russian companies' acquisitions abroad, which will benefit their economy as well. So I'll close there.
Okay, thank you very much, Neil. Straight over to Vlad.
Thank you, Janusz. It is good to know that influential political figures such as Senator Ruger are deeply committed to the agenda of energy diversification for Europe via the South Caucasus. I happened to be present at the NATO summit in Riga in 2006 when Senator Ruger made an extremely well-thought-out proposal about NATO for energy. It was not going to endow NATO with energy distribution functions, but it was going to capitalize on NATO's consultation and decision-making mechanisms to create an instrument to respond to energy crisis and to assist countries that are targeted with energy cutoffs by Russia in a crisis. The proposal was very well argued, but unfortunately it did not get anywhere in practical terms, and I think it would deserve continuing consideration. NATO is the only existing transatlantic mechanism for coordination and for decisions by the partners in the transatlantic community. Energy security is a common transatlantic concern. It cannot be divided between an American concern in national terms and a European concern in terms of European Union policy. Global energy markets being increasingly global, it follows that solutions to energy security have to be reached on a transatlantic basis. This would ensure the political cohesion of NATO and of the transatlantic community. It has been historic policy by successive American administrations of both parties, before and after 1991, to make sure that Europe does not fall into overdependency on Russian energy supplies. Such an overdependency would limit the ability of European importing nations, energy importing nations, to take decisions in the interest of the transatlantic community as a whole. And we have seen this in graphic terms at the NATO summit in Bucharest, the next one after the Riga summit, the NATO summit in Bucharest in April 2008. Is there a direct correlation between overdependency on Russian energy supplies and political concessions to Russia? Is there a correlation between these two factors? The answer for the moment is rather ambiguous. There are cases to demonstrate such a correlation and cases to disprove such a correlation. The exhibit number one is, of course, Germany. Germany has a record high level of energy dependency on Russia among the old EU countries. 40% dependent on Russian-delivered oil and 40% dependent on Russian delivered gas. And the palpable result is a reduction in the German government's latitude of decision making, both in the national interest and in the transatlantic interest. And a byproduct of this, with destructive consequences, is the creation of pro-Russian lobbies within countries such as Germany that are affecting both domestic and foreign policy and are an outgrowth of Russia's energy exports through local interest groups. So that's exhibit number one, that such a correlation exists. But there is also the opposite case. The Baltic states and other countries, new members of NATO and the European Union, some of them are almost 100% dependent. But their foreign policies do not reflect that dependency due to a strong European and transatlantic political commitment. And then there is the case of Italy. Italy has minimal dependency on Russian, and low but growing dependency, still minimal, on Russian energy deliveries. But the government is politically aligned in many or many issues with the Russian government. The same is true of France. And the answer there is that policy is driven by influential domestic constituencies and interest groups, prospering on the back of Russian energy deliveries, even if those deliveries account for only a relatively small portion of the national consumption. But my brief today is to provide a comparative analysis of the two projects, Russia's South Stream gas pipeline project and the European Union's Southern Corridor project for gas. We distinguish between the Southern Corridor as a geographic notion, the transit corridor through the South Caucasus, which is designed for oil and gas, and the specific Southern Corridor for gas, also known as the Corridor Number 4, for natural gas to supply the European Union. We are focusing so much on gas. Gas is the oil of the 21st century. Gas has become the fuel of choice for energy, for electricity generation. And its importance grows even more because of the clean fuel goals of the European Union, the so-called 2020 goals, which mandate a dramatic increase in the consumption of clean fuels, such as gas. And moreover, gas, delivered by pipelines, creates long-term bilateral dependencies between the supplier country and the importer country. And such bilateral dependencies can have a corrosive, maybe even destructive, impact on the multilateral commitment on the part of recipient countries. South Stream is a reflection of a Russian policy to maximize available capacity for export of gas through pipelines to the level where export pipeline capacity substantially exceeds the actual availability of gas export volumes from Russia. Russian policy is to deliberately create a substantial difference between export pipeline capacity and actually available gas volumes. This is a policy that dates back before the economic financial crisis, and it is designed to administer Russian exports of gas to Europe by pipeline as a scarce commodity centrally administered from the Russian center and distributed to various sets of consumers, which Russia would like to compete among themselves for priority access to Russian gas. That is the reason behind Russia's construction, deliberate programmatic construction, of surplus export capacity by pipelines in relation to the actually available gas volumes. The recent financial economic crisis helped to disguise this policy somewhat. The policy began before the crisis around 2003-2005 as part of Russia's policy to play off various sets of consumers against each other induce competition and control the supplies. Moreover, access to in this environment of gas being handled as a scarce commodity, with Russia in the controlling center, had also the goal of ensuring that Gazprom and other Russian companies acquire energy infrastructure ownership on the territories of European countries as a precondition for those countries to be supplied with Russian gas. The acquisition of infrastructure in co-ownership by Gazprom on those territories had become a precondition to entering into supply agreements with Gazprom. One Russian analyst, Mikhail Korchemkin, spoke of a pipeline construction frenzy by the Russians out of all proportions or proportion to Russia's actual gas export commitment potential. Nord Stream is one manifestation of this policy. South Stream, its correspondent in the south. I have described South Stream as a political bluff, and I'm going to explain why I consider it as a political bluff not to be taken seriously. In their conversations with as many as maybe 8 or 9 possible customer countries for South Stream, Russian officials have never identified the reserves of gas to supply the South Stream pipeline. There has been no earmark of Russian gas reserves or gas reserves in a third country for South Stream. Never. This contrasts to the situation of Nord Stream. At least the first stage of Nord Stream has a gas earmark in Russia. The fields at Yuzhno-Russkoye and Achimovskoye. They are not going to fill completely even the first stage of Nord Stream. But there is an official earmark, and we know that part of the first stage capacity will be filled. No such reserve allocation for South Stream. That's number one. Number two, the Russian officials, beginning with President Medvedev and Prime Minister Putin, are simply juggling with figures regarding South Stream's capacity and costs. In the short period of time between early 2008 and mid-2009, the declared Russian costs of South Stream grew from a declared $9 billion to a declared $25 billion, without explanation. And the declared future capacity of South Stream grew from a declared 30 billion cubic meters per year to a declared 63 billion cubic meters per year, again, without any explanation or without any reference to any source anywhere. South Stream has often been described as a way for Russia to bypass Ukraine. This is also a political bluff. It is designed to intimidate Ukraine into ceding partial control. In one form or another, there are various forms of ceding control. Partial control over Ukraine's gas transit system to Gazprom, whether in the form of a consortium or in trust management or in renting out or in... there are several other forms. Many Ukrainian politicians, including President-elect Yanukovych, fear or profess to fear, as an excuse, that Russia would bypass Ukraine, deprive Ukraine of gas transit volumes, shift them into South Stream, unless Ukraine agrees to share control of its transit system with Gazprom. But the reality is a completely different one. Prime Minister Putin and Gazprom are currently negotiating with Turkey, with Bulgaria, with Romania, and with Greece to prolong existing supply agreements for those countries through pipelines that cross Ukraine. And Russia is negotiating supply agreements with those Balkan countries for the future to continue supplying them through Ukraine, not through South Stream. Moreover, Russia offers to include even Romania into that arrangement. Moreover, Russia has agreed, I mean Gazprom, has agreed with Slovakia to continue exporting gas through the Slovak Slovak transit pipeline, which takes all of its gas from Ukraine and continues onward into Western Europe. So the Russians are negotiating long-term agreements with all those countries for gas that would pass through Ukraine to reach them. Further on Ukraine, the European Union and Ukraine, the government of Yulia Tymoshenko, signed an agreement in March 2009 regarding European financial and technical assistance to the modernization of Ukraine's gas transit system. The cost of modernization is estimated by the European Union at 3 billion euro. Compare this to the cost of South Stream, as declared by the Russian side, of $25 billion. Clearly, South Stream is not a viable option to bypass Ukraine. And the Russians don't want it. The Russians would like to get a share of control on Ukraine. So that's why I'm saying that South Stream is, in its form, a political bluff, but in its essence, it is an anti-diversification project because it seeks to inhibit investment into the Southern Corridor and Nabucco. It seeks to inhibit that investment by creating the impression that the market is already preempted and that the capital market, financial markets, would be tapped before Nabucco and the Southern Corridor of the European Union get to those markets. Now my timekeeper is signaling that there are only 2 minutes left. So I'm going to try to concentrate as much as I can the Southern Corridor and Nabucco in the remaining 2 minutes. The European Union, the European Commission, issued what is called the Second Energy Strategy Communication in November 2008 to create the Southern Corridor for Central Asia and Azerbaijani gas to Europe via the South Caucasus. The Nabucco pipeline is the first element, the main element, but not the only element in this corridor. The European Union does realize that Nabucco is initially conceived at a declared capacity of 31 billion cubic meters per year, is not in itself sufficient to make a significant difference in terms of reducing Russia's share in the overall European consumption. Therefore, a more ambitious project is necessary, and that is the Southern Corridor, which, apart from Nabucco, also includes the Turkey-Italy-Greece interconnector, the TAP pipeline, and most importantly, Turkmen gas coming across the Caspian Sea to Azerbaijan and onward to Europe. There are three elements that make this corridor not only possible but feasible. The first is the availability of vast reserves of Turkmen gas, as certified by the Gaffney-Klein audit in 2009, certifying at least 6 trillion cubic meters of gas at just two onshore fields, Yolotan and Osman. The second element is the availability of the Azerbaijan-Georgia overland transit corridor, based and conditioned, however, on the continuing Western orientation of both countries if they are able to continue to pursue their Western choice of both of them. And the third necessary element, which the European Union is trying to put together, is aggregate demand in Europe. Aggregate demand is necessary in order to secure large volumes of Turkmen gas. Turkmenistan may not feel tempted or incentivized by the prospect of exporting 5, 7, 8 billion cubic meters per year through Nabucco and period. Turkmenistan needs to be incentivized with very large volumes. And for that purpose, the European Union has created something called the Caspian Development Corporation, CDC, mandated to generate aggregate demand in Europe, pull together all the demand presentations from European customers and present them as a unified offer to Turkmenistan and potentially other gas suppliers. And now to comply with the time limitations that Janusz has just reminded me about, I'll conclude with this final thought. We finally know what European policy is. There has been no European policy until November 2008. We finally have a European policy. True, its implementation has been delayed by the transition at the European Commission it had its own transition, just like Washington has it had its own transition. But at this very stage, U.S. policy is no longer as clear as it used to be, far from as clear as it used to be, at the executive branch level. There is a decommitment by the executive branch of the United States from the South Caucasus and from the energy agenda. There is a strategic disengagement. I've heard Ambassador Morningstar say that Nabucco can perhaps even have Russian gas in it, that the South-Southern Corridor is not so important anymore, that Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan was not for the European allies but mainly for Turkey, and that the United States cannot be more European than the Europeans. So the Washington-Brussels synergy is no longer what it used to be. Washington is no longer keeping pace with the development of a U.S. of a European Union policy that Washington itself had encouraged, wanted to see, and now that it's materializing, U.S. policy is receding. That's where we need to work. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, Vlad. Next, straight on to Koray.
Thank you, Janusz. Thank you, Janusz. Before talking on the Turkish policy on Southern Corridor, I will just briefly try to picture the Turkey's energy profile and fundamentals of its energy strategy. And at one point, when I realize that your eyelids are getting closer to each other, then I will move on the Southern Corridor to attract the attention. Very briefly, with a rapidly growing economy, the energy demand in Turkey is rapidly increasing. According to a study which is done and published before the global economic crisis, Turkey has been the second country after China in terms of natural gas and electricity demand increase. Turkey's primary energy consumption is expected to rise by a pace of 4% per annual. To make it simple, for instance, in 1990s, the number of cities that we were using natural gas in households were only about 3-5, and today it's it reached to number 63. So these figures are staying on one side. And on the other side, we had our limits of our own domestic energy resources. Given our increased demand for resources, energy resources, and inability to own these resources, the results ended with a kind of dependency, unfortunately, on energy imports, primarily on oil and gas. At present, only 30% of our total energy demand is being met by our own domestic resources, and the rest is being satisfied from a diversified portfolio of imports. That compels Turkey to follow a multidimensional energy strategy to secure its energy security in the first place. On one hand, we are trying to diversify our energy supply routes and resources. On the other hand, we are trying to enlarge our energy basket, trying to increase the share of renewables and also nuclear. And also, we also take steps to liberalize our energy market. Our primary aim in that regard is to realize, of course, our own energy security, and then to contribute to the energy security of Europe, especially to our neighbors in the Balkans. And third, to help the upstream countries, especially the ones in the Caucasus and in Central Asia, to try to help them to ensure their economic prosperity. Turkey's strategic location is actually a kind of blessing in this whole equation, because on one side you have world proven reserves, almost 70% of world proven hydrocarbon reserves, and on the other hand you have energy hungry markets of Europe. So Turkey emerges as a natural bridge between these two regions. Major pipeline projects and the ones which are already in place and the ones which are proposed will contribute to Europe's energy supply security. It will enhance our own role as an important and as a reliable transit country on the east-west as well as north-south energy access. The current pipelines, the BTC, which became operational in 2006, the BTE, the gas pipeline, which became operational in 2007, the Turkey-Greece interconnected, which became operational in 2007 again. And also the old one, the Kerkük-Yumurtalık oil pipeline from Iraq, which was established back in 1976, which is almost as old as myself. They're all functioning well. Of course, there were interruptions in Kerkük-Yumurtalık during the wars in Iraq, but it was not because of Turkey's fault as a transit country. Now, within this strategic larger framework, let me talk about how do we see Southern Corridor. We attach great importance to the construction of the pipelines that will allow natural gas and oil to flow from the Caspian Basin, as well as the Middle East, to Europe via Turkey. This is not a simple rhetorical policy statement. It's based on a visionary thinking, because it is beneficial not only for Turkey, but it's also beneficial for all stakeholders that will be involved in this project. What are the benefits? As I mentioned, it will increase not only our energy security, but our partners' energy security as well. And it will also increase the energy security of Europe. It will increase our role as a strategic and reliable partner for both upstream and downstream countries. It will enhance stability, security, economic prosperity of upstream countries. It will enhance economic and political interdependence among these countries. Imagine if there are more pipelines, say, between Azerbaijan via Georgia, going to Vienna, for example, then the fate of Tbilisi will be in parallel with the fate of, let's say, Vienna or other countries in Europe. So it creates political interdependence. That's why I would like to highlight that this is not a policy statement. There are substantive issues that actually make these projects so strategic and important for us. When we talk about Southern Corridor, I would like to specifically talk a little bit about Nabucco project, which we see as the fundamental piece of the corridor itself. But before moving to Nabucco, just a couple of words about ITGI and TAP as well, and also the Trans-Caspian pipeline projects. On the ITGI, the Turkey-Greece leg has already been established and it's operational as of 2007. The remaining part of the interconnectors, the work is underway on this. In terms of Trans-Adriatic pipeline, we just recently signed an MOU with the Swiss government in November 2009, where the two countries agreed on promotion of financing schemes, on enhancement of Turkish natural gas infrastructure, as well as construction of a new pipeline. On Trans-Caspian, which actually we were a supporter of it in 1990s, and which seems to be a bit idle project for a certain period, we still have the will about it. In 2008, the presidents of Turkey, Azerbaijan, and Turkmenistan get together to try to resolve the outstanding issues on the delimitation of the Caspian borders. But it's still on the table. There comes the issue of the fundamental piece of the Southern Corridor, which is Nabucco. Last year was a successful year for Nabucco. The signing of the IGA in Ankara in July 2009 was an important milestone. The IGA has already been ratified by 3 out of 5 of the partners. It's under discussion. The ratification process is under discussion in Turkey and Bulgaria. And the Turkish parliament will ratify it soon. There is no political obstacle in terms of the ratification of it. The project support agreements constitutes the second phase of the legal framework of the project. The Nabucco Consortium, in the meantime, together with the state parties as well as the PCAs, have also concentrated their efforts on environmental and social impact assessment studies. So the work is going well. We have also covered an important path in the formation of Caspian Development Corporation. Both the UN and World Bank picked up Cambridge Energy Research Associates Group, who is working on a viable model on this. They are working on models like trader model or bundler model or whatever. They published 2 reports last year, and we believe the work is nearing to completion. What are the challenges that are often mentioned by Nabucco skeptics, let's say? The first challenge that is often voiced is the lack of resources. How do we fill this 31 BCM? The second point, as argued by, as it being as a challenge, is the gas talks between Turkey and Azerbaijan. And thirdly, a lack of unified policy on behalf of the EU as well as within the Nabucco partners itself. Let me just briefly mention on these three different challenges. In terms of resources, Shah Deniz 2 gas is the first and foremost option for Turkey for Nabucco. The gas is there. There are two very strong companies in the field, and they are just waiting an agreement to start to drill. But this is not enough. This is not the sole option, because solely Shah Deniz 2 will not be sufficient to fill the Nabucco gas. Turkmenistan lately is giving positive signals to international community and to us as well on bilateral basis in terms of expressing its willingness to transport its gas to Western markets through Turkey. Iraq actually recently started to be an important option as well. With only a 300-kilometer long pipeline, it's possible to put the Iraqi gas or to link the Iraqi gas to Turkish national grid. A parallel pipeline can well be built to the existing Kirkuk-Yumurtalık pipeline, which will be economically quite viable. In October 2009, we signed with the Iraqi government an MOU, which foresees establishment of a natural gas corridor between the two countries. There are also other options like Qatar gas and Egyptian gas, but of course these are for long-term discussions. It is for sure that we are not maybe swimming in an ocean of natural gas at this particular time, but also there is no reason to be pessimistic about the future of Nabucco because of lack of resources, because there will be available resources, and we know that they are there. So the potential is great. On the second challenge, Turkish-Azeri talks, which will probably be an important subject of discussion today. First of all, I have to reiterate that gas issue is only one parcel of our wide relationship with Azerbaijan. Energy talks are going on a discrete format. Recently, there are news suggesting that the two countries have agreed on the price of Shah Deniz 1, which is a welcome development. There are issues which is politically linked and economically linked, because you cannot dealing many issues in the region. Energy is one issue. Nagorno-Karabakh is another issue. Turkey-Armenia relationship, rapprochement is another issue. So there are some complexities over it. But we are hopeful for the possible solution of it. And third, EU not talking with single voice. I personally agree with this. At least as Mr. Sokor said, up until 2008, we didn't see a unified voice from the EU. This is also valid for opening an energy chapter with Turkey as well. To conclude, Southern Corridor is a strategic choice for Turkey, for our energy security, for economic gains for all stakeholders, for political stability, again, for all stakeholders, for interdependence. That's why, thanks to this vision, we were able to sign IGA last year in Ankara. East-West Energy Corridor is actually a project that was developed by the Turks and the Americans and the Azeris in 1919. So this is actually our project. We own it. This is a product of a visionary approach. And this visionary approach, I can mention it in the Q&A section, also includes from northern to southern ties as well, including Medstream that will go from Turkey to Israel and then to India. It's with this strategic thinking that we will continue to support the realization of Southern Corridor. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Koray. Straight over to Elin.
Thank you, Dr. Bugarski. I will try to be brief because most of what I wanted to say has been said, and some things I want to say I would better leave to our keynote speaker, Dr. Beliabev from Azerbaijan, who, along with Vlad Soker, probably know more about details of energy situation in the region than anybody else. I would like to stress that being outside my otherwise beautiful consular district. I'm speaking on my own behalf, not on behalf of the government. I'm in my personal capacity. And as Jason Epstein pointed out, today is the Red Army Day, so we could say that it's a day off for me. So I'm speaking in my personal capacity. Just to follow up on what Ertash Bey said and Mr. Brown said, I would like to applaud Mr. Luger's vision for the importance of the energy security in our part of the world. In fact, it was his leadership in many ways which made things happen, and we know at the end of the last administration as well. The issue is not his vision, but that we need to have more visionaries like him and more focus. And that's an important thing, because what we see today in our part of the world is, as we talked about, is the lack of the focus from our friends here in Washington, and not only from Washington, also from the Europeans, and in fact, the lack of consistency in their politics. And why this is important? One thing we have learned throughout the 90s, and Ertash Bey focused on that quite eloquently, is that we understand now the importance of energy and energy security, for security in general. I mean, energy is simply vital. If you switch on TV today on CNN, you would see that not only energy is vital, but also natural gas is apparently the new buzzword in advertising when you do it on American TV. That's the new big thing here. And it's true. As Vlad Soker pointed out, it is the oil of the 21st century. Now, we've been saying that for a while. As Shafak pointed out, one of the unpleasant things which we face today is that so many things which we are facing today, so many challenges we see, are so predictable. And I don't want to say always, I told you so, but at least I did, and so many others did. I mean, come on, we all know this. And so many things we're saying today in a positive way can come true, and in a negative way, I hope, would not come true if we just take a specific focus on the region. Let me say what I mean. Let me focus on something else as well. Azerbaijani view of the situation, of the energy situation in the region, is very simple. We have always said that diversity is a key to energy security. And what we mean by that is that for consumer countries, of course, it's a diversity of supply, and Azerbaijan contributes to that significantly by being one of the consumers who is competitive, and one of the producers, I'm sorry, who is competitive and wants to be on as many markets as possible. For producing countries, it is, of course, diversity of consumers and diversity of transit nations, because any form of monopoly, be it a monopoly of a producer, be it a monopoly of a consumer, or be it a monopoly of a transit nation, is always an issue. And we've been seeing that in many ways. I mean, some of our friends in Europe have faced it with the monopoly of a producer. Some of our, we may face it with a monopoly of a consumer, and all of us sooner or later face the issue with the monopoly of a transit. So, as a result, what Azerbaijani approach has been is to diversify as much as possible. And this is what you have today. Azerbaijan basically exports its energy resources in all directions imaginable directions available in our part of the world at the moment. Of course, as always, our preference has been what we initially called East-West Corridor. Now it's called Southern Corridor as a general idea. And it was a visionary leadership of people like Heydar Aliyev and then President of Georgia and Turkey, Eduard Shevardnadze and Süleyman Demirel, strongly backed by the Clinton administration, which made the fundamental piece of that, the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, happen. Now, why it's important? Because we look at our friends in Turkey, and we see that Turkey has a growing ambition of becoming a regional hub in the region. And I would say it's a very justified ambition. I mean, Turkey is very well located to do so. Turkey is a fundamental nation for the region. It's very good. In fact, this is what we want to see. Not only do we support that, I would take a credit for making that possible, because our good friend Ertash Bey just emphasized how important was Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan and BT to making Turkey this fundamental hub. And that fundamental pillar should not be forgotten. So we should understand that Caspian energy is very important for Turkish regional significance. And that's a good synthesis. It's, as Vlad once called it, synergy for energy, or energy for synergy. I don't remember which one it was, but it hasn't been working very well. In any case, that is what is important. Another part of our pragmatism, I think, and why am I saying that is because I would say that pragmatism is a trademark policy of both previous President Heydar Aliyev and clearly of today's President of Azerbaijan, Mr. Ilham Aliyev. What I would call it visionary pragmatism. What it is that we take realities on the ground into account and we have a vision for the region. Let me say what I mean. Azerbaijan understands that we cannot be fully successful in the region which is not fully successful. So we want to see success of our region. That means success of us, success of our neighbors, success of our friends. That's what drove our relation with Turkey. That is what driving our relation with our good friend Georgia. If you look today at Georgia, we all like to talk about Georgia. Not now, of course. A couple of years ago, it was the most favorite topic in this town. I was amazed by the number of discussions on Georgia 2 years ago and quite visible lack of them now. So that's actually quite an interesting contrast. But speaking of consistency of the U.S. approach to the region, by the way. But Azerbaijan has been consistently friendly with our good friend Georgia. In fact, Sokar Georgia, the Azerbaijan state oil company in Georgia, is the largest taxpayer in that nation. And I'm happy to say that because we want to make sure that Georgia survives and moves forward and is a successful nation. That is in our interest. That is in the interest of the region. That is in the interest of everybody. Now, in that context, I would touch on something which has been touched already quite extensively and has been an issue of discussion among our friends. I would reiterate what our good friend Fariz Ismailzadeh has said. Azerbaijan is not opposed per se to normalization between Turkey and Armenia. Azerbaijan likes the idea that our neighbors can talk to each other. What we don't want to do is to end up in a situation when symbolic important issues overcome and overshadow the reality. The reality today is that the unresolved status of Nagorno-Karabakh conflict remains the single most important challenge for the future of our region, not history of the region. I'm sorry to say that. I know history matters. And sitting here 100 years old, history matters. But trust me, 1992 history of Khojaly, which happened 3 days from now, 3 days, 26th of February, in 1992 also matters. Yet I will not condition my relationship and my relationship with Armenia and everybody else based on that massacre. I'm thinking about the future. What are we going to do? How are we going to have a complete region? How do we move forward? That is an important issue. And U.S. focus on symbolism, unfortunately, unlike the real challenges to the region, has distracted that attention for what could have happened. So we like the energy, positive energy, which Turkish-Armenian connection brings, but we want to see it expanded into something much greater. I will not speak much more about this. I will just say that something which has been emphasized here repeatedly, and this is the lack of leadership on the energy transits in Western direction. I mentioned earlier that Clinton administration leadership was very important. So is now American leadership and Western European leadership on that issues again. Europeans always like to talk about energy monopoly, energy diversity. That reminds me of the great state of California and posted that, where everybody sits and talks about green energy and then they go and drive their very heavy cars because there's no public transportation. That is inconsistent. Similarly inconsistent is the fact that we talk about energy all the time, energy diversity, but then we go and like the monopoly. That is not what we want to see. We want to see leadership. We want to see a clear approach to this. Now, on the final point, of course, in conclusion, I'm sorry. In our part of the world, it also matters not only what you say, but also what you do. The lack of ambassador in Azerbaijan might make issue very easy for the protocol office of the foreign minister because they don't have to issue many papers, IDs, and it's easier to take care of DCM than it is of the ambassador, but it does not contribute to strengthening of our relationship. And it does send a message. And as much as Fariz Esmaeilzadeh is trying to convince me that it doesn't really matter, I am being, after all, most of the time, not today, a diplomat posted to the United States, do feel that it is an issue. Anyway, I spoke too long. I know both of the timekeepers are looking at
me, so I will basically seize at this point.
You almost got a red card. No, thanks very much, Elin. A few brief comments from Mario, then I want to open up to the floor immediately to get as many of your comments as possible.
This is a vast and important topic, and instead of going and doing nitpicking with the presentations, I would like to say the following. If you are a great power, if you're calling yourself the only remaining superpower, have a policy for crying out loud that reflects that. Don't let things slide. When things slide, bad things happen, especially in bad neighborhoods. And unfortunately, I love the Caucasus. I love South Caucasus. But it's not the best neighborhood. It's not Nordic Europe. So bad things do happen. Secondly, are we going to waste almost 20 years of bipartisan policy that started under Clinton and continued under George W. Bush of developing democracy, security, and energy in the Caspian Basin, in the Caucasus, and to the extent we could, Central Asia? Or are we going to waste it and justify it by other engagements? I was told at Case School when I took a couple of courses at Kennedy School when I was at Fletcher that Washington is a one-crisis city, and people in Washington cannot walk and chew gum. I rejected it as the Bostonian propaganda, but unfortunately I'm wondering if this starts to look like the truth. Next, the Europeans need this energy, and they need the neighborhood probably more than we do, but it is awfully difficult to work with the Europeans. It has to be bilateral, it has to be cooperative, but in some cases, when the Europeans cannot sort out who has the phone number that we need to call, is it the Commission, is it the new structure that has been created, maybe in the future, it will be clearer, and maybe in the future, there will be a clear Caucasus policy, South Corridor policy. But unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, it ain't the case now. So what are we supposed to do? Resign ourselves, as we seem to be doing, or in some cases work with the Europeans, but in other cases to work unilaterally? Dr. Bugajski asked me to be brief. You cannot deal with the region without understanding, really, what are Russian priorities. As somebody mentioned before, Russia has its presence felt in the Caucasus at least for the last 200-plus years, and it's going to be there. So do Turkey and Iran. In fact, if you look at history 2 centuries-plus back, there was always a shifting balance of power in the Caucasus between Turkey, Iran, and Russia. It's not going to change. Unfortunately, I'm wondering sometimes to what extent Russia is modernizing its foreign policy. There is a lot of talk today by President Medvedev and others about modernization and innovation in Russia. But when you read the statements or listen to the statements about the exclusive sphere of interests, about the military doctrine that very vaguely, in an undefined way, talks about the protection of Russian speakers, or in some cases Russian citizens, that takes away the authority from the Duma to send troops overseas, abroad, and gives it to the president. You wonder, is Russia, despite its relative weakness, is pursuing policies that have less civilian control and less balance between the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary branches. I think from reading everything we have now available in open sources and looking at Russian performance in Georgia, the executive branch clearly dominates that decision-making process. That raises questions for European energy security. But that issue cannot be resolved without a clear understanding what is what are the economic factors affecting the Southern Corridor and the South Stream. And that is the price of gas. The price of gas went down from about 450 to 500 to about 300 per BC for 1,000 cubic meters. How does that affect the building of the pipeline? The lack of private sector leadership. When you're looking at a consortium that is supposed to do Nabucco, these are relatively small in comparison to large international companies. Companies in Europe, both state-owned and privately owned, but I do not see a leader like British Petroleum was in the BTC project. I also, with all due respect to the European leaders and to the Turkish leadership, I don't see leadership that is comparable to the late Heydar Aliyev, to Edward Shevardnadze, and to Mr. Demirel, and the same level of American support. So when you don't have the economic clarity in terms of where the financing is going to come from for this project, you don't have any feasibility studies going on, and you don't have sort of geostrategic vision, and I here want to mention Senator Lugar's vision because it's one of the few elements that are still there, and you don't have a clear economic vision, this makes it so much more difficult. I do hope, though, that not only this conference but other activities such as this will try to push this issue a little bit higher on the priority list of this administration, that the ambassadors will go to their jobs, that the undersecretaries will pay attention, that it will go at some point maybe to the principals committee in the National Security Council, et cetera, and that our president will realize that if you're looking all the way over the horizon to Afghanistan, there are some very important pieces of that geostrategic puzzle that have to be filled, including dealing with the leaders from the region. A couple of years ago, I think it was a tail end of the Bush administration, a State Department official came to me and was asking me questions about dealing with Turkmenistan, and my answer was, let's get the new president to Washington and get him to the White House, and this is how you can ensure the supply of the Turkmen gas to Nabucco. And, of course, you know the story. Nothing like that happened. So if we are going to be caught in our own bureaucratic infighting, in our own lack of strategic clarity, we're not going to achieve what we need to achieve as a great power. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Eru. Let's open up to the floor. I'm going to take about two or three comments or questions and then come back to the panelists. I saw you first. You've already been a panelist, but come.
Good day to everyone. Domagoj Juričić from Croatian Embassy. Just two brief questions, mainly focused on EU. Maybe Mr. Sokar could answer, but all of you distinguished speakers are welcome. Are we really sure when we say that EU has this one voice energy security policy, or we are witnessing the European Commission wishes versus individual EU countries? And how is possible to achieve energy security position in the European Union with not so transparent energy market, or as economists recently said, noted, with shredderization that is going on in the European Union? Thank you very much.
Just a very quick question. I just want to press the panel a bit more about if Turkmen gas doesn't become available, where would the gas for Nabucco come from? It seems to be a very good project, but if there isn't the gas, then there isn't the project. And I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Okay, thanks. And a colleague from the Armenian Embassy.
Just a very quick comment to what my old friend Edin Suleymanov said on the Azerbaijan's positions vis-à-vis our Armenia-Turkey, you know, process. Just to say that no matter how Azerbaijan portrays his own position, it's obviously it's against the Armenia-Turkey normalization. But what I wanted to emphasize, this is a strategic misconception, because no matter with or without that border open, Armenia's stance, Armenia's position on Nagorno-Karabakh conflict is not going to go beyond certain limits. In the terms of concessions, Armenia has already made its significant concessions. And with or without that border, that's not going to change. On the other hand, I wanted to bring, there are fears in Azerbaijan that if the border is open, Armenia is not going to have enough reason to negotiate on Nagorno-Karabakh. I just wanted to give you an example that, first of all, Georgia's border, and look at the Georgia's border with Turkey, which has been open for so many years, and Georgia's economy is not very different than the one of Armenia. So in that sense, there is no any major difference. And also, on the matter of the border, the last 18 years, Armenia's border has been closed with Turkey. But no matter of that fact, Armenia's position hasn't changed on the principal issue of the conflict, which is the self-determination issue for Nagorno-Karabakh. Lastly, on the issue of the Elin just mentioned about the day of Khojalu. I just wanted to remind that we are also not very far from the days which the first ethnic cleansing was conducted in Sumgayit, second city of Azerbaijan, ethnic cleansings of Armenians, followed by cleansings in Baku, Kirovabad, and elsewhere. But this is not a matter to, you know, finger point each other and say who committed what. I think there are tragic histories on both sides, and we need to overcome it through dialogue, through peace, through cooperation, and through very small confidence-building measures that can be elaborated in this situation. Thank you.
Thanks. Very much reminds me of the Croatian-Serbian relationship that I remember from the 90s, but they're living as good partners now and supporting each other for the European project. Vlad, I think you probably should go first.
Thank you. To respond to the Croatian representative about the unity of views in Europe about energy policy, there is no unity of views in Europe. You are right to say that there is a cacophony of voices in Europe. There is no such thing as a European policy, but there is such a thing as a European Commission policy. No European policy, but European Commission policy. And that is a major development. It's unprecedented. It came about very slowly, because that's how the European Union operates. But now we have an external energy policy of the European Commission with a strategy, and that's the Southern Corridor. That's very important. You talk about shredderization, yes. But look at the new European Energy Commissioner, Günther Oettinger, a German, who in his confirmation hearing to the European Parliament said very categorically that he is not going to be an emissary of Georgian of German business, not an emissary of German government, but a spokesman for the European Commission, and he came out, Oettinger, specifically against bilateral European countries' deals with Russia, and he singled out for criticism the German policy of dealing bilaterally with Russia. So that is a very optimistic development. A word about Croatia, which I did not have a chance to touch on during my presentation. Croatia plays a very important and widely underestimated role in European security. The Adriatic coast is an energy lifeline for oil and gas of non-Russian provenance into Central Europe. Croatia is a great underappreciated transit route for non-Russian energy into the heart of Europe. exactly into that part of Europe where Gazprom and other Russian, Lukoil and other Russian companies hold monopolies. That's why it's so important that your Prime Minister, Yadranka Kosor, who is visiting Moscow this week, should not make deals that would allow the Russian Kremlin-connected companies to grab pieces of Croatian infrastructure in oil and gas, not to allow the reversal of the Druzhba-Adria oil pipeline, to preserve the flow from the Adriatic Sea into Central Europe and not vice versa, and not to allow South Stream, because South Stream would kill the LNG project on Omišalj. And in response to Mr. Deval's question about if there is no Turkmen gas for Nabucco, where would it come from? Then we would be in real trouble. There are two other options, neither of which I regard as viable. One is for gas from Iraq. There are lots of conditions attached to gas from Iraq, from northern Iraq, from the Kurdish-administered part of Iraq. There are lots of conditions attached to it by the central government and by the Kurdish authorities. First, the first value, the gas is not on stream yet. Once it comes on stream, it should first meet local needs before being exported. First, it should meet local needs. The central government in Baghdad does not allow the Kurdish authorities to make their own deals. Western companies are being discouraged from investing in northern Iraq for those reasons. So Iraqi gas is a very long shot. And the other possible option, other than Turkmen, is from Egypt via the newly built Arab pipeline that crosses from Egypt via Jordan, via Syria, reaching into Turkey. It's now completed as far as Syria. But I don't think many European gas consumers would like to put a Syrian hand on that pipeline. So it's not a viable project. There is no alternative to Turkmen gas, and that should be clearly realized.
Okay. Thanks very much, Vlad. My suggestion, because we're going to be continuing with discussions on energy, and our speaker, in fact, will go into a little bit more detail, particularly on the Azeri position. My suggestion would be grab lunch, come back to the table, save your questions, and you can direct to him and also to our panelists. I'd like to thank our panelists, by the way, for great presentations. Thank you very much.